May it please the court, Robert Robinson on behalf of the appellant Kevin Andrews. Mr. Andrews was arrested and indicted for one count of violating Section 4120, which is the Delaware Sex Offender Registration Statute. Because of an incorrect jury instruction, Mr. Andrews was actually found guilty of conduct that is not illegal under Section 4120. And that's what I think is important about this case. If the judge's jury instruction is permitted to stand, then a whole new set of restrictions are placed on people subject to the requirements under 4120. The 4120 has set out a variety of different restrictions for people who are registered sex offenders. One of those, the one that was issued in Mr. Andrews' case, was that a sex offender must provide to the State Bureau of Investigation, or SBI, a quote-unquote residence address. And if that person changes the address within, or if that person moves to a different address, they then have 3 days to notify SBI of that change. Instead of allowing the jury to consider just a regular everyday understanding of what residence address means or a dictionary definition of residence, the trial court imported a very different definition of residence from a completely different section of Title 11, imported it from Section 1112. 1112 is it's a very different statute. It applies, it sets restrictions on certain individuals who were convicted of offenses where the victim was under the age of 16. Because it's intended to be a very restrictive statute, it casts a very broad net. Not only does it prohibit those individuals from residing permanently within 500 feet of a school or daycare center, it also prohibits those individuals from residing temporarily, presumably at a motel or a homeless shelter or even with family or friends in between another residence.
But you agree that even if we accept your interpretation or your argument as to this particular statute, that under the school statute, a sex offender could not stay at a motel.
That's correct.
Within 500 feet.
I would agree with that. But that's not the section that Mr. Andrews is being prosecuted under, or was prosecuted under.
Well, how do we reconcile the language of that statute with 221C that specifically allows a meaning that's not commonly accepted if it is defined in the criminal code?
Well, I think residence is a very commonly understood word. If you look at the Duncan case cited by the state, and they talk about the definition of at, that's obviously a word that everyone uses every day. Similarly, residence is an easy-to-grasp concept that doesn't have any special meaning, I don't think, within the code unless the legislature chooses to define it otherwise. Also, if you look at 1112...
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let's assume someone who's required to register lives in Dover, and they put down their Dover residence, and then they get a job in Wilmington that requires them to work late hours, and they spend 3 or 4 nights a week in Wilmington on a regular basis with a sibling who lives in Wilmington. Under the statute, what, if anything, should they do?
Under the statute, and if the General Assembly wanted the 4120 to apply to those individuals in those situations, the General Assembly could set that out. But I think here you're looking at what a common definition of residence is, and
no,
I think the jury
that
should be permitted.
No, but before we get into this case, let's finish with my hypothetical. Okay. So you're saying if you spend 3 nights in your Dover residence and 4 nights a week in your sibling's home in Wilmington, you don't have to tell anybody you're spending 4 nights out of 7 at your sibling's home in Wilmington. Putting down your Dover residence complies with the statute.
The way 4120 is written now, I think that that's correct. I think that if your permanent address is the Dover address, and that's where you get your mail, that's where your driver's license is listed, that's where you have the bulk of your possessions, that's where your family may be located, all those would point to that being your permanent residence. And 4120 does not prohibit a sex offender from spending nights away from their permanent or their registered address.
Well, following up on Justice Holland's question, does the statute anticipate and or require more than one registration at the same time? In other words, there are people in this day and age who do kind of commute between their home and another location where they spend their time working and sleeping.
Certainly.
Would those people, would the statute contemplate two places of registration?
Well, the statute does not contemplate that. There's nothing spelled out in the statute about defining residence or how long a person's allowed to stay away from their home. Now, the restrictions placed on these individuals could come into play with the probation sentence, where you have to provide probation and there's a curfew that you have to be home at every 10 o'clock every night, or it could fall under GPS monitoring requirements. But right now, 4120, as written, does not provide that information. And that's why I think the jury should have been instructed on a regular, everyday, common sense meaning of residence, such as the factors that I set out.
So your concern here is that by selecting the definition the Superior Court used in this case, it could be construed by the jury to mean if you spent more than one night away from home, that was a temporary residence. And even if there's some room somewhere for dual residences, the jury should have been instructed that you had to at least find, when he was with his former wife, I guess it is, that it was a dual residence, but leaving them the possibility of focusing on one night only being a temporary residence was such a problem that the jury couldn't discharge its function.
That's correct. And for example, you can see where in the prosecutor's closing remarks, he actually stated to the jury that if a sex offender spends one night away from home, that sex offender has a duty to notify the State Bureau of Investigation. That's an incorrect statement of the law of 4120. However, I think with this particular jury instruction, that was not an objectionable or not an incorrect statement of the law because this jury instruction was so broad. And I think also if you look at some of the reasons, if you look at the detective's testimony who arrested Mr. Andrews, she initially testified that it was her reading of the statute, and by the way, this is her job to enforce this statute, that if an individual spent three nights away from or in a different address, that individual had then a duty to register that new address. That's a complete misstatement of the law. I think they were confusing the three-day requirement for the 3 days to notify of a new address. And I think that her mistaken belief is what led to Mr. Andrews' arrest in the first place and then his subsequent conviction. And going with hypotheticals, I mean, if I go on a week-long vacation, I hope someday my caseload will allow me to take a two-week vacation. If I might be gone for an entire week, I might spend a different night of that week in a different location. But the bottom line is, though, I think where my residence, my permanent address is the place where I get my mail, the place where I have the bulk of my possessions.
But wouldn't you agree that the whole reasoning behind the registration statute is that the community and the authorities should know where a sex offender is living, right?
Yes.
And if you focus on a permanent residence, I'm not saying that necessarily what the trial court did was correct at the other end of the spectrum, but if you focus on a permanent residence, then you are leaving out of a protective statute people who can have a regular regular time of staying with, living with relatives in different locations. It's not just a two-week vacation. It's not just I went to see my sister for overnight. It's, when I'm in Wilmington, I always stay with so-and-so, and I'm in Wilmington most of the summers, you know. Shouldn't the statute be read to require registration in those kind of circumstances?
Well, I think the statute, if that's what the General Assembly intended, they should have written it to require that. Perhaps in a perfect world, the community would know where a sex offender is at every moment of every day, but that's impossible. And again, you know, the high-risk sex offenders or people who are recently convicted are monitored through GPS so that they are monitored constantly of where they are. This 4120 just requires, and in Mr. Andrews' case, all 4120 required was that he fill out a form every year, sending it to SBI, telling them where he's living and where he's working. And the way these cases are usually prosecuted is that a notice or form is sent to a sex offender and the letter is returned to SBI as undeliverable. The police go to the residence, they talk to someone at the house, and they said, oh, I haven't seen that person in 6 months. You know, that would indicate a change of residence. In this particular case, the state's entire case was built on some laundry, some barber equipment, and a statement by Mr. Andrews that he spends time at the Church Street address. If the detective had gone to his registered address and the people there had never heard of him before, or if letters had been returned, that would be a very different case. But that wasn't the case in this particular instance. Nor did the jury hear from any of the residents of Church Street or Deer Forest Road that he had abandoned his residence. They didn't hear from any neighbors saying about how long he was at the Church Street address. And I think when I mentioned the prosecutor's comments about the spending one night away from home, that was actually ratified, I think, by the trial court at sentencing when they said the purpose of 4120 is that if someone randomly wants to know where Mr. Andrews is, they can go there and he would be found. More likely than not, if someone had bothered to go to the Deer Forest Road address, they would have talked to his family members who live there. They would have said, Mr. Andrews is spending the night over at his ex-wife's house, or he's spending the day over there watching his kids. I think that's what the purpose of the sex offender registration is to basically have some leads to have an idea of where someone is.
So what is the definition of residence that we should adopt?
Well, I think in this particular instance, either the jury should have just been instructed on, read the statute where it just says residence address and not try to supply a definition, or we could have used a dictionary definition. In the American Heritage Dictionary, the first definition of reside is to live in a place permanently or for an extended period. Obviously, the permanently is very different from the instruction that was used where it said permanent or temporary place of abode. And the 1112 statute is it's intended to be very restrictive. It is intended to place restrictions to keep this set of people away from certain places within 500 feet safety zone, basically, at all times. That's why it even prohibits loitering.
Well, would the definition that you've given, or for an extended period, cover your client in this case? Was there evidence supporting that?
I would argue no. The discussion of the definition of residence arose in the context of a motion for judgment of acquittal. It was my opinion as trial counsel that the state hadn't met its burden to show that he had changed his permanent address from Deer Forest Road to 36 Church Street and failed to notify SBI. Basically, all the state had, literally again, was the laundry and some statements by Mr. Andrews that he spends a lot of time there. And that was it. That was all they had. If there are no further questions, I'll save my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Gregory Smith on behalf of the state. Your Honor, in this case, Kevin Andrews had registered, he was a registered sex offender in November of 2009. The address that he had provided to SBI was his parents' address in Georgetown, Delaware. As a result of a domestic incident with his, I guess estranged wife would be the best description of her, at her home in Bridgeville, the Bridgeville police were contacted and saw him present. Then a no-contact order resulted from that incident. As a result of that, then, Bridgeville police helped Mr. Andrews to move some of his belongings out of the Bridgeville residence. And those belongings included 3 to 4 laundry baskets full of clothing and shoes and barber equipment, including, I guess, materials that would be used to lubricate the cutting devices. Then, with that, the Bridgeville police contacted the Delaware State Police, the specific officers who are involved in enforcement of sex offender registration, based on the fact that he'd observed Mr. Andrews at a location that was not his registered address. So the Delaware State Police came to investigate that. And in investigating, Detective Oliphant, after Mirandizing Mr. Andrews, he made an admission that he had been staying there. He was, quote, back and forth between the Bridgeville and the Georgetown addresses.
If he'd only stayed there one night, would he have violated this statute?
No, Your Honor.
Given the instruction to the jury, could the jury have concluded that if he only spent one night there, he had violated the statute, as the prosecutor argued?
Your Honor, the short answer is no. As a temporary abode,
the jury would not have been misunderstood by either the instruction to the jury or the prosecutor's argument into thinking that staying there one night was a violation of the statute.
Certainly, the prosecutor's statement that one night would be enough is not helpful to the state's position here.
Well, that's
to put
really
it mildly.
A euphemism, isn't it? Not helpful. It's not right.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Not an accurate statement of the law.
Yes, Your Honor.
So my question is, given that inaccurate statement of the law, was the instruction from the Superior Court such that the jury would have known one night was not enough?
Your Honor, under the facts of this case, yes. And here's why. The state still had to prove the mens rea, that it was knowing or reckless that Mr. Andrews was not re-registering the Bridgeville address.
No, I understand that, but let's talk about the temporal nature of the visit. You could knowingly be there one night. You could knowingly be there a week. What someone has to know if they're going to be charged with a crime is, at what point in time am I committing the crime? So based on the statute, what is the timetable that he would have had to stay at the Bridgeville residence to violate the statute if it's not one night?
It would be a period of 3 business days, Your Honor. That's when the reporting requirement kicks in. The state could not properly charge an individual for failing to re-register under this statute if he had not been at a residence for more than 3 business days. And
so if he was registered at his parents and he stayed in Bridgeville on Monday, Thursday, and Sunday, he wouldn't have to do anything based on what you just told me, because he never would have been there for 3 days.
That's a possibility, Your Honor, yes.
Well, no, but we're talking about a criminal statute here, and I'm really just looking for your help. Help the court understand what you do to violate the statute. And your initial response was, if you stay somewhere 3 days, you violated the statute, you need to register, even if you wind up with 2 residences. And I can understand that. But if that's the law, then a person in the defendant's situation would say, okay, I understand the law. I'm going to stay there Monday, Thursday, and Sunday. And I'm not going to be violating the law because I'm never going to be there for more than 3 days.
And then I think, Your Honor, that would go towards is the defendant knowingly violating the law at that point? If he's articulating that as his understanding, that I didn't think I needed to report because I didn't stay 3 consecutive days that I didn't therefore need to report that.
Well, help us understand what you want us to do in this particular case, because you've admitted staying there one night does not violate the statute, and the prosecutor's statement that staying there one night violated the statute was an incorrect statement of the law. So we need to know two things in this case. What is a correct statement of the law on what constitutes a violation of the statute? And second, was the jury properly instructed on the law so that they could discharge their function?
If I may take that in reverse order, Your Honor, yes, the jury was properly instructed. Because that definition of residence comes from Title 11. That must be, and instructing from the Delaware Code must be an appropriate instruction.
But well, doesn't it have that qualifier for purposes of this section, which takes it out of the operation of 211?
In section 1112, Your Honor? I don't believe that it says, I guess 1112B for purposes of this section, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
So does that take it out of the operation of 211?
And no, Your Honor. Here's one of my reasons why. Then even though under 4120 subsection F, that part of the statute does not say temporary, under the immediately preceding paragraphs under E, that section does likewise discuss temporary. And then if we look at 4120A, big A, intent and purpose, we don't have to just guess what the legislature's intent here was. The General Assembly wants to have continuous monitoring of registered sex offenders. And then if we tie that back into the idea that multiple requirement to register multiple locations, that would be in 4120F itself, because that section discusses the name, but that's not relevant, residence address, place of employment, and or study. So clearly, somebody could have more than one job. And if they have more than one job, there's nothing to say you only have to register one of your jobs. And I guess if I – so returning to Your Honor's original hypothetical, I'm sorry to be bouncing around. You posed an individual as a Dover resident, works in Wilmington, and stays several nights on a regular basis with another family member in Wilmington. And, yes, the state would say that would be – that individual would need to register both addresses based on the statute, the legislative intent, this idea that, you know...
Let's assume that's correct. And I mean, that's very logical. You can have two places of employment. You can have two residents. So just assume we agree that's logical. What we're trying to factor into this case is if staying someplace one night doesn't qualify. You don't have to send in any notification if you're somewhere for one night. And the prosecutor argued in this case one night was enough. Using the definition that the Superior Court used, could the jury have concluded one night was enough? It doesn't matter as a general proposition that you could have multiple residences. What matters is you don't have multiple residences if you're only there one night. So in this particular case, could the jury have thought that the law was one night was enough to violate the statute?
Under the facts of this case, no, Your Honor. And the reason being specifically Mr. Andrews' admission to Detective Oliphant, when she asked him, have you stayed more than three consecutive nights, and he acknowledged that he had, in addition to saying that he was back and forth between the Bridgeville and Georgetown residences. So based on...
That's in the record, that he specifically said more than three consecutive nights.
Yes, and that would, in the transcript, it's at pages 58 and 59, and I'm sorry that I'm not, I don't believe that's in the appendix.
We'll find it.
But 58 through 59 is where that came up.
Since we're more or less at this point, where does the 3 days come from in your definition of what the time frame is? I realize that you have to register within 3 days after you change a residence. But how do you get from that the notion that you reside somewhere if you stay there for 3 consecutive days?
Your Honor, I have to acknowledge that it's somewhat, we get there indirectly, because if the statute could not be enforced until 3 business days had lapsed, whether somebody intended perhaps to change their residence before they even moved, and they've already scheduled the move to take place, this statute could not be enforced against that person because it would still be anticipatory.
So in other words, the state is taking the shortest period of time that would not be nonsensical in terms of the actual provision that says you've got 3 days within which to register. Therefore, our definition of residence is 3 days.
Correct, Your Honor.
So going back to what Mr. Robinson was saying about vacations and your focus on intent, where does that leave us if you're going to take a 1 week vacation? You're a registered sex offender in Wilmington, and you're going to take a 1 week vacation in Bethany Beach. What do you do under the law?
I guess I should first acknowledge that Detective Oliphant, her testimony regarding vacations was that she would expect that sex offender to contact SBI and let them know, but that
I'm asking you, as the Deputy Attorney General arguing this case, how do you want us to construe the statute? We've established that one night is not enough. You're focusing on intent with an emphasis on 3 days. And now I'm trying to find out the logical extension of what's going to constitute a statutory violation. What do you do if you have your residence registered in Wilmington and you're going to take a 1 week vacation in Bethany Beach?
Your Honor, I've struggled with this a great deal, and my struggles, if I may, I guess, explain some of those before I try to give you a direct answer. I have a fear that we have, when we talk about vacations, we think of them as maybe those of us who have more regular jobs would take, you know, a set time away from a place and go somewhere on vacation, knowing that we are coming back to our residence. Unfortunately, many people who are registered sex offenders aren't going to have a kind of traditional residence.
I know, but, you know, and I don't want to use up all of your time with the question, but I think we have to assume that there are registered sex offenders who have regular jobs and who do take vacations. And as a regularly employed person with a residence in Wilmington who takes vacations, you want to comply with the law because you're already in big trouble. My question is, if you're in that, even if it's a small group of people, what do you do under the statute if you're going to take a week's vacation in Bethany Beach?
Under that hypothetical, Your Honor, it's the state's position that would not be required because that would not be a temporary abode. The greater fear is for someone who sets, you know, use their parents' address as a mail drop, flits from one relationship to another, ends up going from couch to couch, and then says, well, none of these places I'm not intending to be any of those places that long. Perhaps I'm just on vacation visiting one of my girlfriends.
Well, help me understand where intent relates to this. Let's suppose you're just going to visit your sibling. We're not calling it a vacation, we're calling it a visit. And you visit your sibling in Bethany Beach for 5 days. Somewhere along the line in your answers, you wanted us to focus on 3 days. If you're going to be somewhere for more than 3 days, you need to register under the statute. But there seems to be a vacation exception. That if you can go on a vacation for a week because you don't have the intent of doing anything except being on vacation for a week. But under the three-day rule you're advocating, if you go visit a sibling for 5 days, but it's not a vacation, would you have to register or would you violate the statute?
I don't believe there would be a violation of the statute with that, Your Honor. And that the, again, and part of the way the state proved the case here, I think, goes to show that they took his prior annual registrations and presented those to the jury to say to the jury, this Mr. Andrews knows what the requirements are. He knows what he's been doing. And in fact, he's changed on a regular basis. It's not the same address year after year after year, starting in 2001.
Yeah, well, let me say that the purpose of my questions isn't to disagree under the facts of this case, that you could make an argument he had a dual residence, and that if you could prove he had a dual residence with his parents and his former wife, he violated the statute. The legal question before us is, was the jury adequately instructed under the law about what it was he had to do to establish a dual residence that required registration that he didn't do in this case? Or, based on the prosecutor's argument and the judge's selection of this particular definition, could the jury have concluded he violated the statute when he had not?
I don't believe under the facts of this case the jury could have concluded that, Your Honor. Here this sort of gets back to the procedural posture of this case, that the challenge is not a challenge of prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument. It's a challenge to the jury instruction that was given. And certainly Mr. Andrews objected to the jury instruction as given. I don't believe he proposed an alternative instruction of residence. And when this court's reviewing a jury instruction that was given, its duty is to decide, was that jury instruction an accurate statement of the law? And it certainly was, Your Honor, because it came directly from the Delaware Code. And then the question is, did that instruction as given serve to confuse or mislead the jurors? And in this case, we can at least say, Your Honor, no, that it did not, based on the facts as presented.
And that's partially because, in your view, it would be a completely accurate statement if the prosecutor had said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you find that he was at this place for three or more days, then he's violated the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
And since you had evidence that he admitted he'd been there for more than 3 days, you figure you're golden. What if the definition isn't 3 days?
If it's not 3 days, Your Honor, then certainly that would call into question the definition of temporary abode based on the extensive testimony regarding 3 days that took place throughout the course of this trial. There's no getting around that. That three days was repeated over and over, and I would not suggest otherwise to this court.
Do we have any information as to why residence was not defined? Apparently other states defined it in their statutes. The federal government defines it in SORNA and provides guidelines that habitually lives means, or a sex offender lives for at least 30 days. And apparently Pennsylvania has a rule where you're domiciled for 30 consecutive days or more. Maryland uses 5 hours per visit more than five times within a 30-day period. The absence of this specificity, doesn't that suggest that the ordinary, commonly understood meaning of residence was intended?
I believe my time's up.
Please answer the question.
Yes. No, Your Honor, I believe that because it was defined elsewhere in relation under 1112, that definition was assumed to be the one that would be used.
Just very briefly, I think that these types of hypotheticals get into why this section is so problematic. We really have no idea when someone's in compliance with it or when they're not in compliance with it. And that was the problem. That was the troubling aspect of this instruction, was that we really don't know where where the cutoff is, whether it's one night, three nights, a week, 30 days. It's arbitrary. The state police, the State Bureau of Investigation, Department of Justice, Detective Oliphant, they may want it to be 3 days. That might be their practice or what they hope sex offenders would do, but that's not required under the statute that Mr. Andrews was found guilty of violating. Also, there was some discussion about the intent to return to a residence. That actually wasn't, I did look at the transcript very briefly. I didn't see any mention about intent to change address or anything like that. That's what this trial should have been about. Did he change his residence address from one location to another, and did he fail to notify SBI of that change?
Well, Mr. Smith makes the point that under the statute, you need to put in your place of employment, singular.
Sure.
And that if you worked in two places, you'd probably be expected to put two places. Assuming that makes sense. If, in fact, you do have two residences, even though the statute uses residence in the singular, why shouldn't you have to list both residences?
Well, sometimes we do come across this as a practical matter, just from handling these types of cases, where someone is employed in one location and takes a part-time job somewhere else. Maybe they help their uncle put on roofs on the weekend. I don't know that that's a requirement. I mean, there are different definitions of employment, and if he were being prosecuted for not listing his place of employment, those are all factors that we would get into. How many hours a week does he work at the second job? Where does he get his paycheck from? Things like that. I mean, for example, we'll have situations where someone's a carpenter who may work on different jobs, four different locations in a week, I don't think anyone would say that they have to call up SBI every time they go to a different job site and let SBI know where they're going to be on that particular day.
Well, let's assume we agree, and let's craft the hypothetical where you work 20 hours a week at one place and you work 20 hours a week at another place, week in and week out. Two jobs, same number of hours. You would agree you'd list them both.
That would be, yes, that's probably what should happen.
All right, so then we can say hypothetically that you spend 3.5 days a week in one residence and 3.5 days a week in another residence. By analogy, you would list them both. Is that right?
Probably so.
So even under the statute, we agree if you have two residences, you list them. If you have two jobs, you list them.
Although I think it's...
And the problem in this case is not whether you need to list two residences if you have two residences, but what is the definition of a residence so you know what to list?
Right. And I think your example of employment is much easier because someone could theoretically work 20 hours in one location, 20 hours at another, get half their income from each location. Residence is a little bit more tricky to define. I don't think anyone could evenly split the amount of clothes they have or their amount of possessions or get half their mail at one address and half the other. It's not as easy to split up.
You can imagine the situation where you spend 20 hours a week working in Wilmington and 20 hours a week working in Rehoboth, and you'd probably reside in two different places half of each week, to accomplish your both jobs.
That's probably true. Although I would also argue too that, I mean, I think most people, just from general experience, have a house that they consider their home that they return to. I don't think very many people really do truly split two residences. Even people that might have a vacation home in Florida where they spend 4 months out of the year down there, I think that a lot of them would still consider perhaps Delaware to be their primary residence.
But you're thinking in terms of people who are in the fortunate position of having more than one home to live in.
That's correct.
There are also a large portion of our population that is not in a particular residence for very long because they get evicted and then they stay in a motel until they can find another place, or they stay with a relative or a friend, and they are pretty much on the move every several
Absolutely.
Weeks because they have to be, not because they want to be.
Especially sex offenders.
And,
they have a very hard time,
you know,
finding.
Aren't they going to be responsible to keep re-notifying the authorities every time one of those events happens?
Absolutely. Once they change their residence, yes, they have to notify SBI. And unfortunately, that happens very frequently because not many places will want to rent to a registered sex offender. There are not many, because of restrictions in other parts of the code, there are not many places where they can live, and then they always have to notify SBI.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.